Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea's sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, arts editor here at the TLS. Thea, our usual host, is away, so we're delighted to have the literary powerhouse that is Alex Clark, longtime writer for the TLS and friend of the podcast, here with me. Hello, Alex.
Hello. I love being a powerhouse. I mean, aren't things, you know, that the government calls powerhouses usually a disaster?
Oh gosh, I've just thought of that. No, I didn't mean that.
No, it's okay. I'm gonna reclaim the word. I like it.
Yeah, a fully funded, fully supported literary powerhouse, not just a manifesto promise. You are talking to us from, in fact, excitingly, a different country, aren't you?
I am. I'm actually talking to you from the Republic of Ireland, and here I am in the southeast, and sitting on a wintry day, looking out at the hills and mountains of South Kilkenny. So yes, I'm joining you by the magic of Zoom and the Times Literary Supplement's brilliant technical wizards.
Our huge tech department. Yeah, exactly. It's nice because it feels like we've got one foot, you know, we're gradually reaching around the globe. did you not get the storm then? We had a big storm here over the past weekend.
Actually, no. The north of the island got it. I mean, it was very, very windy. And I must say, I live on top of a hill. So when it's windy, it is pretty windy. And it's sort of tie down your dustbins time. And we did a couple of winters ago lose a fairly large section of tree, which thankfully missed large structures and cars and people, obviously. But it, in fact, just swept by us and we just had a bit of wind and a lot of rain.
Okay, so you missed the worst of it. Speaking of the worst of it, I'm going to tell you what's coming up on this week's show. No, I'm just kidding. It's going to be brilliant. Coming up on this week's show, what you always wanted to know about the practice of log rolling, but were afraid to ask, and we will definitively reveal how you could become happier, thinner, and more productive. No, in fact, we won't, but we will talk about self-help books. But first, we're looking at the world through rose-tinted glasses, not because we're blindly optimistic, but because we are talking about roses. We have two pieces on this most symbolic of flowers in the paper this week, one talking about the cultural history, ranging from Christian iconography to the Surrealists to Virginia Woolf to the Reagan administration, all of whom have something to say about roses. The other piece is about Rebecca Solnit's book, Orwell's Roses, though we are warned that it isn't really about Orwell, nor is it really about roses. Happily for us, Margaret Drabble, who brilliantly reviewed it, is here to tell us what it is about. Margaret, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, I know Rebecca Solnit, I think, says it isn't about Orwell or roses, but there is a strong connection, isn't there? What's the story of the roses of the book's title?
I think the central story is that Orwell planted some roses that he bought from Woolworths in his little allotment garden plot before the war, and then was very proud of how they developed. And she has sort of woven a story out of that and spreading into all sorts of other roses. But the original roses were Orwell's, and her point is that Orwell, although portrayed as being a grumpy ideologue, in fact loved the natural world, was a good gardener, and enjoyed his garden plot very much.
Yeah, so he was. So it's that. It's a different idea to the one that we're used to, isn't it? That the idea that there's a lovely quote about that he takes joy in everyday things and in beauty and in the land and in animals and flowers.
Yes, he really did. I mean, he did also shoot quite a lot of animals, but then that was just what English people did. Even of people who liked animals did shoot them, and he killed a lot of snakes on Jura. But on the whole, he was in favour of the natural world. And enjoyed being outdoors and walking and rambling. Rebecca Solnit's a tremendous rambler, but so was Orwell. He enjoyed walking too.
And tell us about the importance of Woolworths, because you think that was quite significant that he bought them at Woolworths.
Yes, well, because Woolworths was such a demotic kind of space. It was a place where everybody went for cheap things, and it was part of the childhood of anyone of my generation. You could get mixed sweets in a paper bag.
I remember the mixed sweets. They were still going.
Them.
They were still going when I was little. Yeah.
No, it was a sort of magic emporium, and I think that Orwell was particularly pleased that he'd bought these beautiful flowers and cherished them and looked after them, and they had borne fruit, like in a biblical parable. They had done very well for him, and he liked the feeling that any human being with a little tiny plot of land could do exactly the same as him. He wasn't the kind of person who bought his flowers or roses from a posh nursery, as some people I know do. He just was happy with his Woolworths.
Yes, there is a kind of thing about roses and class, isn't there? Because you say also that he didn't think they were bourgeois. They can both be seen as, they can be looked down on and sort of seen as posh flowers, depending almost on what sort of roses you buy and, as you say, where you get them from.
That's absolutely true. I do remember being once astounded by a woman friend of mine who asked me, "Where do you buy your rose shrubs?" The answer was, "I don't." But she obviously put people into categories of people who use very superior nurseries and people who just bought them at Woolworths, as it then was. And it was obviously a social grading in her eyes.
Yes.
And I was kind of dumbfounded by this question. I didn't know what to say.
And there's also the sorts of roses, aren't there? Because you talk about I think you mentioned at one point, you know, there's hybrid teas, which were very, very popular at one point. But then there was a movement against those, the kind of aristocratic Sackville West kind of went back to the old roses because they weren't keen on the hybrid teas.
Well, I do know people who are very keen on the old roses and who send me photos of them. But not being a rose expert myself, I can't tell what sort of little messages they're sending out. I just say, what a beautiful flower. But I know that there's a message with it and with its name. I occasionally walk in the rose garden in Regent's Park, and I don't really understand the differences between the different kinds of rose and what their social significance is.
I have to say, I'm just going to fess up here. I love the old roses.
You do
as
love
well.
The old roses.
I do. My parents love them, so I've got a couple from them. And they've often got very, very beautiful names. They're often French. Josephine.
They have very beautiful names.
Yeah, I think that Josephine's, Napoleon's Josephine was a great breeder of roses.
Yes.
And I wonder if a lot of them come from there. I don't know enough about it.
They probably do. My poet house sitter was very, very keen on roses, and he loved their names too because he was a poet.
Yes, yeah. But I'm making you go off on a tangent there. Sorry, we need to talk
well,
about
I
George.
I just want to say before we leave these roses, there's a rose that I deeply regret ever having planted, which was a rambler. I think mermaid. What a menace!
They can just take over the world. The ramblers.
They've taken over the world, and I have torn my fingers on them so often. They are so dangerous.
What was it called? Did you say? Sorry.
I think it's a mermaid.
Okay, well, be warned, listeners.
Be warned. Don't get a mermaid. Don't put it in your terrace. You'll never get your terrace back.
Exactly. You can only plant one of those if you have huge grounds and you need to cover them at speed.
I just didn't know.
Yeah, it's a...
it was ignorance on my part.
So to go back to the book, you call it, you say that, and you said that Orwell was a rambler and that Rebecca Solnit is a bit of a rambler. You call it a series of meditations. It's a kind of, is it a meandering read? Is that a fair characterisation?
It's an extremely meandering read. And what is good about her style is that she admits this all the time. She sort of says she's going off in a different direction. And sometimes the directions are quite surprising. But I think it was a difficulty for her that she had to finish this book under lockdown, because she's a natural walker and an outdoor person. Mm. And she was locked down, and she never got to Jura, which was Orwell's final kind of garden, his garden out of London. And she would have so loved to have gone there, I felt. So some of the ramblings never happened, but some of them were only tangentially attached to Orwell and were absolutely fascinating too.
I read a piece by her in which she said she said graciously that she was very pleased with how the book had been reviewed, but a number of people, not you, of course, called it a collection of essays. And she says in this piece about it, she says, to me, that's like calling your family a collection of people or a tree a collection of sticks.
I wouldn't have thought of that, but I can see it isn't a collection of essays because they are all deeply interconnected. And she's very keen on the idea of the rhizome and the way we are now increasingly discovering that all trees are connected underground in a way that we didn't know about. I mean, we knew that fungus had these huge mycelium that stretched for hundreds of miles sometimes, but we didn't realise that trees were so interconnected underground. And her collection of meditations, or whatever she would like to call it, is always connected, but sometimes, rather surprisingly, a little shoot pops up somewhere where it shouldn't.
And one
I quite like that.
Yes, yeah, yeah. One of the sort of the ways that she takes is she looks into bread and roses, doesn't she? Which seems, again, that seems a very Orwellian idea, not in the sort of popular, as you say, grumpy ideologue sense, but in the sense that people really need both of those things.
They need art as well as food. Yes, I thought that was a very interesting chapter to me, because I hadn't known the history of the phrase. And she's very good at etymology, and she digs back through etymologies and false etymologies to see when the phrase was first used, which I don't think she ever quite established. But the idea was certainly in Orwell's thinking that people needed, they needed art, they needed books, they needed the outdoors, they needed music, even cheap popular music, as well as just bread.
Mm. And it seemed to start with feminist socialist organisations at the turn of the century. Is that right? Is that where it goes?
Yes, I think it was. I mean, it was. I can't quite remember because it is such an episodic story. She starts that section with that very famous photograph of roses by a woman who did become a very strong radical feminist revolutionary. I've forgotten her name momentarily.
Gina Modotti, was it?
That's right, that's absolutely right. But this image of roses, which is very, very famous and has been infinitely reproduced, and I think Madonna bought a version of it. It's a sort of female icon, but it's also a revolutionary icon linked through her life story, which ended in a very abruptly. What she does with bread and roses is take you in many different directions and tells you little stories about the different directions it went in, which I found it very enjoyable.
Mm. And then to use the word again, Orwellian, again, not in its familiar sense, you say the best and most powerful chapter is actually quite Orwellian, about the business of rose growing in Colombia.
This was, to me, the most interesting section, because she takes off to Bogota in Colombia to look into commercial rose growing, because she had a hunch, which I feel some of us most of us must have had, that when you buy commercial bouquets, there's a history of exploitation behind it. And she goes to Bogota with somebody who's quite good at making his way into unionized or non-unionized groups. And they explore what is actually happening to the workers. They're suffering from repetitive strain injury. They're not allowed to unionize. They have to wear these slogans saying how happy they are growing these roses. And that, to me, was it was the backdrop of those bouquets that we see at St. Pancras Station every day, you know, where they, in fact, in the UK, they come from Africa, but in the US, they come from Bogota. I just found that tracking back to the source really, really interesting. And it also raised this crucial question. When Orwell foresaw 1984 and totalitarianism, was he also thinking about commercial exploitation and the kind of algorithm world that we're in now, or was he simply thinking about political exploitation? And is political exploitation as bad as exploitation of our commercial instincts? I found that really interesting little questions raised by the rose growing story.
Mm. I didn't realise that they had to wear the slogans.
Yes, it was part of the workforce.
Right, I see.
Well, so they would choose to put such rubbish on your chest?
That's a good point.
I did find that. And also that you're supposed to look all cheerful with your slogan. But Rebecca Solnit got behind the back of that to hear a few real genuine complaints. And I also, if I remember rightly, there was a good sounding charitable green body connected with this rose exploitation place that actually had that was a bit of a sort of greenwasher or whitewasher, because they hadn't really got to the bottom of what the workforce was actually doing. That's what I felt, that there was some kind of fudge going on about the workforce there, which was being treated badly.
Well, that's another thing about the as you say, the exploitation in the whole sense that maybe he was looking into, but because that's also an exploitation of nature in the sense that we shouldn't have roses all year round, should we? I mean, however repeat flowering they are, we shouldn't have them in January or February.
We're so we became so accustomed to expecting to have things all the year round, but in fact roses do bloom amazingly late in the year sometimes. But now we have learned But within sort of the last 10, 20 years, to connect this all-the-year-roundness with things being flown in, and therefore air miles, therefore carbon, and we are making these connections far more than we used to. But it's very interesting that in Orwell's projection was of a world in which people had almost nothing. They fought over a bar of chocolate, whereas what has actually happened is a world of excess, and we're being ruined by excess rather than meanness and division within a society, or by warfare. I mean, Orwell thought we were going to, that he projected a future in which the world was perpetually at war, which hasn't happened in quite the way he predicted. But what we have now is commercial exploitation, which has resulted in this huge disparity between the haves and the have-nots, which we know has increased since 2006 exponentially.
And that his idea of double think and double speak is still there.
Totally.
In a very obvious way, with the slogans on the front of the workers, but not always in the political way that he suggested.
No, it is more, it's reached a bigger plane, really, a sort of an everyday plane of double speak about products.
And you say
I find really interesting. I mean, I try not to be outwitted and try not to be brainwashed by products, but it's very, very hard to help it, because and occasionally sometimes it works and you get what you really needed and didn't know you needed it. But
yes.
On the whole, it's selling you things you don't want.
Yes. And you say as well, just at that, about that, the place in Bogota, the production line, the roses there, a lot of them are not, they're not very nice. They don't smell. They don't look good. Is that right?
Well, certainly she says that the they look good in a kind of artificial way. They look. I mean, I know there's a difficulty between the scentless rose and the scented rose and the old rose, and that some of the new varieties are scentless, and nobody seems to care about them being scentless. But she actually does say some of them are positively ugly, I'm not quite sure what she's summoning up with the word ugly, but it is true that sometimes these commercial bouquets do look offensively unreal.
So Orwell would be doubly horrified, wouldn't he, by the roses themselves and by the whole system that has produced
the
roses
themselves.
He would be
horrified by the system, and he would be he wouldn't think the roses looked real. And he really was quite a keen gardener, and I like the thought of him digging up his garden and shifting all that soil and making things grow in Jura. It's good.
And proudly telling you that this one was from Woolworths and it was, you know, cost 2 and 6 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. No, he very much wanted to be, although he'd been to Eton and was a product of Empire, as we know, he really wanted to connect with what we might call ordinary people. And when he went to Wigan Pier, I think Rebecca Solnit's bit about Wigan Pier and the Industrial Revolution is not terribly good, because it's stuff we all know in this country too well. But Orwell was so appalled by the spectacle of real working people and the lack of hygiene and the stuff they ate that he found it very hard to reconcile his mission to make the world better for everybody with the people who were actually living in this world and didn't necessarily want to live in a better world. And I feel that that Rebecca Solnit explores that contradiction in him. And to me, the idea that he is enjoying flowers from Woolworths means that he has joined the human race. He's part of common everyday pleasures. And that obviously pleased her, and it also pleases me.
Yes, well, it's very pleasing for all of us, and thank you for helping us, to guiding us around the meandering, the rhizomatic thinking, which is such a nice way of thinking about the whole thing.
It is a good meander. Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, what log rolling really means when it's not used in a literary context. And we'll be talking to the author and academic Catherine Hughes, who has reviewed a deep dive into the world of self-help books. And just a quick heads up, there is some strong language in this section. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we find out how to help ourselves, can we just turn back to last week and the little discussion we had about log rolling when we were talking about books of the year? So, Alex, we were talking through, you know, our writers' selections of books of the year, and saying that we had to be careful to advise them not to do any log rolling, which in quite yes. a narrow, I realise, literary sense just means, you know, recommending their wives' books and their friends' books, which people have routinely done for us throughout the years.
And find ever more kind of subtle ways to do, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And exactly. And then we made a rather pathetic attempt to define what we thought real log rolling was and where it came from. There's a political sense, I realise, as well, isn't there, where people do deals with each other. Mm-hmm. But we were talking in a more or less uninformed way, totally uninformed way, about, you know, rolling logs down to the river. And we had a brilliant letter from a very helpful listener in Vancouver, in British Columbia, where they've been having a terrible time, it has to be said, with the weather. I was mentioning storms, but they really had a terrible time. So I hope that's all better. And the listener says, I had a bit of a chuckle when I heard you on the podcast struggling with what it means to log roll, and sent a link to a film on the National Film Board of Canada, which explains the whole thing. And the song is The Log Driver's Waltz, and it's actually performed by the wonderful McGarrigal sisters, Kate and Anna. Alex, what did you think of the film and the song? What did you learn about log rolling?
I was so charmed. I mean, I think I would have said I sort of knew, roughly speaking, you know, that it was about transporting logs by means of water, and that the people who did it had to sort of rather nimbly, you know, hop from log to log in order to do it, and that I myself would not possibly be able to do it, having no coordination or balance. But seeing the film of it just made you realise quite how nimble they are.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
Really amazing. And then this, I loved the song, was just, you know, I love folk music, but I wouldn't say that I knew very much about Canadian folk music, for example. And I found it absolutely delightful, didn't you?
It was wonderful. So it's a very beautiful, merry song about the girl saying that it's called The Log Driver's Waltz. And the girl is saying that the log drivers, which is what they're called, the guys who are skipping about on the logs, they're the best at dancing because they're so nimble and fleet footed. And it's got quite a few verses. And she goes through and says, well, because of my parents, I have to dance when we have a dance. I have to dance with the merchants and the doctors and the lawyers. And they've got good manners, but they can't dance. None of them is as good as the log driver. And then at the end, she ends up with the log driver. What I love is the final line of each chorus. The log driver's waltz pleases girls completely. It's just such a brilliant sign-off.
Well, it's very, I mean, let's be truthful and let's allow the listeners to kind of weigh in on this. I just heard that as a complete double entendre, I must say. But
I didn't until you pointed it out. But now
I think there's a sort of little bit of twinkly, gleeful naughtiness in that refrain, a log driver pleases girls completely, and there's a sort of bounce of in it that suggests, you know, that their sort of well, their nimbleness, their dexterity, their fleet-footedness might have many applications, not simply those on the sort of social center dance floor.
Right, okay, well, that's very relatively delicately put, Alex, thank you.
I'm the log driver of euphemism. Let's just put it like that.
Well, it's a beautiful film, and a lovely song, and it is itself a waltz. Quite right. It's in three, so it's a lovely. If you want to, I would very much recommend going to the film. So you go to the National Film Board of Canada, and then you just have to put in log driver's waltz. But we'll put a link to it up on our page. I highly recommend everyone to go and spend 4 or 5 minutes learning about log rolling and jumping around to the log driver's waltz.
It's so much more wholesome, isn't it, than the log rolling you were talking about last week?
It really is. It's just much nicer. Much nicer. Well, it was wholesome until you got your hands on it. I thought it was terribly wholesome.
Sorry, that it was ever thus.
But now we're going to turn to you, Alex, because you're going to talk us through how to be our best selves. Is that right?
I mean, I know, of course, that you, Lucy, and again, our esteemed listeners probably are very close to being their best selves. But yes, I am. The art of helping yourself It often feels like you could spend your days reading self-improvement tomes. Indeed, it's a genre so chock-full, you'd barely have time to read anything else, although there's probably a book telling you how to find more time to read. But there's more to self-help than at first meets the eye. At least that's the premise of The Art of Self-Improvement by cultural historian Anna Katharina Schaffner. Catherine Hughes has reviewed it for this week's paper. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Alex.
What a fun thing to write about. Just tell us first, this is a book that goes way beyond the sort of Who Moved My Cheese and How to Get Rich Quick books, isn't it?
Absolutely. Schaffner makes this really important distinction between self-help books like Who Moved My Cheese and self-improvement, which is something much more sort of, well, to use the word mindful, which is the buzzword at the moment, but something that's just much richer and much deeper. And what she does very cleverly, I think, is make us see the difference between those two things. So self-help might be all about how to get ahead at the office, but self-improvement actually might just be about how to be a better colleague, friend, employee, or boss. So it's much richer, it's much fuller, and the rewards, I think, are kind of spread much further. They go right into society at large.
So the kind of idea of self-help is sort of goal-orientated, I suppose. It's how to get something, basically. Self-improvement is, I suppose, another buzzword, is a kind of holistic approach to the self and to society.
I think you can even go deeper with it. I mean, self-help presupposes that you're quite happy with the way the world works in all its late capitalist rottenness. You're not trying to change any of that, the unfairness, the awful, blatant sort of misery of it all. You're just going to carve out a nicer path for yourself. Mm. Self-improvement, she thinks, is actually about, you know, you might decide that you actually want to change the world, but in order to do that, you've got to change yourself first. So there's more of a promise of action if that's what you want to do. But I think she's very good. I mean, she's very good at making that point that, you know, self-improvement can fall into a sort of awful cloying sort of self-esteem talk, which ends up as narcissism, where basically you become the subject and the object of everything in the world. At the other end, if you become very stoical, if it's all about let me just put up with everything in the world, that can be also a very sort of determinist and deflating kind of position. So she wants us to make or to think about finding a way between those two poles so that we don't assume that, yeah, the world can be remade in our image, but nor do we think, heavens, it's all helpless, I better just go away and die in my hole.
let's not think that, shall we?
That is a route to just, you know, endless Netflix and crying, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's an interesting sort of journey to chart between them. It's much deeper than you might originally think from Who Moved My Cheese. I could never work out how working out who moved your cheese would help your life.
I think the point is, actually, Lucy, it wouldn't. It came in for an awful lot of flack in America. That great historian of ideas, Barbara Ehrlich, neatly said, you know, Who Moved My Cheese is simply a sort of Bible for people who are about to be made redundant. It's sort of telling them how not to be too upset about it. I mean, it wasn't going to help you at all. It was going to help the people who were in charge of the cheese. Mm. But where I think this is a serious, important book. I mean, Anna Katharina Schaffner is a professor of cultural history at Kent. What she's very interested in doing is taking what might seem like slightly facile titles that we're all aware of, like Awaken the Giant Within and even Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, these slightly slogany kind of books that we've heard of, even if we haven't read them. And she wants to trace them back to their origins, where they have a much sort of richer starting point, often in classic Stoic thought of the first century AD, or back to the Renaissance, back to Montaigne and the Renaissance. So her point is, they may seem a little bit glib, they've been packaged, but if you actually think about them, understand where they come from and perhaps trace them back to their origins, it starts to make a slightly richer, deeper sort of sense.
I must say, when you said, even if we haven't read them, I am actually a person who has read quite a lot of them. I'm a real sucker for this sort of publishing. And I did wonder, and you go into it, and I think probably Anna Katharina Schaffner goes into it in much more depth, how they began to emerge in this kind of common incarnation. I mean, we know about, for example, Dale Carnegie and How to Win Friends and Influence People. That's right back in the 30s. But what was the point at which they became something that the modern reader began to buy in droves?
I think it's a movement that walks hand in hand with great improvements in the publishing industry. So from about 1850, where we get new ways of publishing, new ways of making paper, we've suddenly got a sort of mass readership of newly literate populations in Western Europe and America. That's when you start to see these books being pumped out. Interesting, 1859 is a really interesting year. Samuel Smiles in 1859 published Self-Help. And actually, that was the same year that Isabella Beeson came out with her Book of Household Management. Both those books are absolutely designed for a mass readership. They're designed to both go far and wide. You can get hold of them cheaply. The idea is that now it's a sort of democratized kind of experience, both reading about these things that you can do and then putting them into practice. So I would say that's when it really starts to seem like self-help has kind of saturated the culture. It's really interesting, though, how those books continue to get misread. I mean, I remember back in the day when Sir Keith Joseph was the educational secretary under Mrs. Thatcher. He was so enamoured of Samuel Smiles' Self-Help that he wanted a copy distributed to every child in Britain, which kind of boggles your mind, because in Self-Help, it's all about get up at 4 o'clock, learn some Latin before you go for your factory shift. If you happen to get a bit, I don't know, let's say you happen to get lame, just get your leg amputated in the lunch hour. Don't take any time off. And then you can hobble back to work and continue your way up the managerial tree. Now, how Keith Joseph thought this was going to help state school children in the 1980s, I have no idea. But it is interesting that it's an idea, just the word self-help, Victorian values, still has a kind of odd, creaky currency today.
The getting up at 4 o'clock has kind of cycled back round, hasn't it? Because now we're all supposed to get up at 4 o'clock and not necessarily learn Latin, but go to the gym for 2 hours or whatever. That's still a thing.
I think it's really interesting, Lucy, how during COVID, especially sort of the first lockdown a year ago, lots of people seemed to look upon that time of enforced rest, not as just a time to kind of chill out, but actually to put new behaviours in place. So exactly, getting up early, doing lots of gym work, making your own bread, being the person you always wanted to be. I think Samuel Smiles would be very, very approving of that. The trouble is it didn't really last. So we went from making our own bread to getting pissed in front of Netflix quite quickly. But it's
which is its own form of self-help, of course.
Yeah, of course it is.
I would say there are some very educational documentaries on Netflix. Admittedly, they might not be what we're watching, but interestingly, you know, that mention of Keith Joseph there and Samuel Smiles, it points to a kind of evasion of the state in some ways, doesn't it? That if we're all trying to improve ourselves and be self-reliant, we're not going to look to the state to do it for us. And I wondered how much a lot of these books address a kind of authority gap where we might have at one place looked for guidance in our lives to religious organisations, to the government. And now we have kind of somehow, I don't know, taken in this idea that we've got to do it all ourselves.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the reason Keith Joseph so likes Samuel Smiles is that really it's a doctrine of small government. It's a doctrine where you are responsible for yourself. You must do everything. It's nobody's job to help you or to encourage you to think in a certain way. I think that's absolutely right. I think it's no coincidence that these kinds of cheap books that I was talking about, self-help and the Book of Household Management, become very popular just at the point where there's a sort of crisis in faith, where fewer and fewer people are going to church, because they embody a kind of low evangelical Protestant kind of rigor and dourness, and you must rely on your own conscience to tell you what is right and what is wrong. Interestingly, neither Smiles nor Beaton were church people at all, but that didn't stop them borrowing that kind of language that is what the vicar used to tell you. Now there is no vicar. You've got to look to yourself. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think this is where Schaffner is rightly quite sceptical about a lot of these books. She feels that they are, Who Moved My Cheese, as I say, it's not about actually deciding whether we need cheese in the first place or whether everybody needs a bit more cheese. It's actually just about making sure that you get some and you don't get too upset if a big hand descends from the sky and takes it away. The problem is, of course, that if you go the other way, if you believe yourself to be entirely formed and programmed by your particular set of social circumstances or your embodied presence, that leaves you very little wiggle room to do anything about it. It then becomes a sort of quite defeatist if it's all a question of throwing up your hands and going, well, I can't change myself because there is no place for change. I am the way I am. That also is really quite difficult and unpleasant and unpalatable. I mean, she makes a very good point. If we really believed that, then we would have the death penalty back in Britain, because if we didn't believe that people could improve themselves or do better or make something of themselves, well, we just judicially murder all people who are convicted of a capital offence, and we don't do that mercifully. That's because we do deep down believe that there is possibility of improvement, and if not transcendence, perhaps some sort of salvation.
It's very interesting that, as you say there, there is this idea of the connection that our improving ourselves will have with the rest of the, with people around us, that the impact we can make on society. I mean, Schaffner, and I think you, as you're writing about her, do say that self-help can be a collective enterprise. It can feed in to our civic duties and our political duties.
I think that's right. She's got a very, very good section, very, I think, persuasive about those books which have the word, and I'm going to say a rude word, fuck it, somewhere in the title. So I don't know if you, coyly, they always use asterisks, but John Parkin wrote one in 2007, Fuck It, The Ultimate Spiritual Way. Then Sarah Knights had one, The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck. I have to admit, I did read that one. And then there was a more recent one, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And where she takes issue with these is that these books posit themselves as a way of giving up and surrendering in a sort of Buddhist or Taoist way, in the sense of just giving up your inland empire and just going with the flow, and that's a profoundly spiritual thing and will help everybody else around you. She makes a very good point. That is not what the Buddha was talking about. That is not what Taoism is about. Letting go in its original context isn't about just acting out your own stroppy desires. It's about letting go of worldly attachments and the ego, so that you are more able really to serve the people around you. And I think that's a really, really interesting distinction she makes. The point about letting go should be that we have more energy and it becomes available to cure, to care and attend to others. And the way the Fuck It books describe it, it just sounds like a load of teenagers kind of going up to their bedroom and locking the door.
It's a distinction, isn't it? It's not to say, I don't care about anything. Who cares? It's actually, I'm going to care less about the stuff that I particularly want and see what I can do outwards. It's a bit more that kind of thing. Is that
absolutely
right?
Absolutely. It's about sort of calming the inner voice, not just so as you'll feel a bit better and sleep right through the night, but because you'll have more attention and energy to give to the world and to other people.
It's interesting, isn't it, the way that a lot of these things have spilled out into the culture generally. So we have, I mean, it's always something or other month, giving up something month, do, you know, writing so many words in a day, not drinking for January. There's this idea that this constant sort of work on the self is kind of in every part of our lives, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. And I think that possibly comes back to that sort of mid-19th century feeling of, you know, your conscience is now your God. Nobody's going to make you do anything. So it is up to you entirely to police yourself. And that's incredibly exhausting. I mean, that's just incredibly, just exhausting and impossible. And of course we know, don't we? Because we keep on buying and reading these books. And I'm a great one for downloading apps that tell me about all these sorts of things. We know that in a sense it doesn't work. Otherwise we wouldn't be constantly renewing our engagement with all this material. So in a way, it's getting us all frothed up into a very sort of tortuous inner state where, again, we are entirely self-obsessed.
I do want to, if we may, pause for a little while on the subject of Marie Kondo, who Shatner talks about, and so do you. And, you know, as with many of the kind of books that we've discussed, they are sort of ripe for mockery, even if of a gentle kind. But she makes the point that actually Kondo is doing something valuable with the kind of spark joy idea, even if it has been sort of reduced into a slogan.
That's right. The great thing about this book, which I really enjoyed, is that Shatner never goes for the easy joke. She never goes for the smirk. And as you say, poor old Marie Kondo, or perhaps quite possibly poor rich Marie Kondo,
I think she's very, very wealthy. Very
she would be so easy to mock. But Shatner says, no, let's not do that. And she makes a very good point. I mean, Kondo doesn't speak English. So the fact that her message has gone right around the world in translation tells you something about its potency. It just does. She also links it back to particular, this is where she's very good at finding genealogies for things. So she links it back to Shintoism and also the concept of wabi-sabi, the impermanence of all things, which starts to make a kind of sense. And I guess is a sort of Japanese version of non-attachment. Shatner also, very admirably, I think, for a university professor, makes it quite clear at the beginning of her book that she has read all these books. She has done all these books. She is trying to be, you know, 5 pounds lighter, a better parent, all those things that we need to be, we want to be, and we read these books. So she's absolutely clear that she finds something very cleansing about the Kondo idea, that sense in which there is something quite dramatic about what it does. By changing your environment, you do, in a sense, clean up your interior life so that it's no longer full of very odd socks and, you know, socks with holes in them.
Well, I have noticed when I'm very sort of worried about something or preoccupied with something that I generally, something I can't control the outcome of, a good tidy goes very well. And I also kind of think the flip side of it, I am possibly unhealthily attached to watching those kind of hoarding programs that they have on TV. And what is painful about them is always that the person who is doing the hoarding, there's always a trauma. There's always something horrible that they're compensating or avoiding. And it seems on that basis that something like, you know, cleansing your sock drawer, which sounds so trivial, is a kind of mindfulness, to use another often devalued word, but it does bring you into attention in your own life, doesn't it?
I think that's right. One thing so many of these philosophies have in common, and again, Shatner very, very good at making connections across culture and across time, is that sense of making space, whether that's internal space or space in your sock drawer, or a sort of philosophical pause where you can put distance between you and the immediate environment. So she talks a lot about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which of course is prescribed under the National Health Service. Now, some people will be very, very, psychoanalysts will be very, very sniffy about that, will say it doesn't get to the root of anything. But those who are very keen on it, and many people are, suggest that it just creates a space between the thing that's hogging all your attention, be it, you know, your problematic child or your holy socks, and your reaction. So it builds in a sort of 5-second pause. And that is incredibly helpful. And I think that's what Schaffner seems to find in all of these very different philosophies. I mean, she's not suggesting that they can be collapsed into one master narrative or anything like that. But what they all seem to do is make a little breach, a little space in the way in which you consider the world.
I wonder, does she say anything, and I'm assuming possibly not, about the kind of real sort of dilution, about the kind of endless, you know, internet hacks, the 5 ways to, you know, lose 5 pounds of belly fat or clean your fridge out or all that sort of thing? Because that's where I sometimes think, actually, despite the fact that these books seem to sell so well, are they at some point just going to all go into kind of 5-minute podcasts or 5-minute films on how to declutter?
I think that may well happen, but I think, to be fair, her book is a kind of resounding answer to that. So what she does is comes it the other way around. She, in a way, starts with the 5 ways to clean your fridge, or, you know, 10 ways to be a better daughter. And she makes them richer and more complicated by tracing them back. So she's absolutely aware that that is the process. But what she seems to be saying in this book is, don't be put off by that. Don't have that sneer that's so easy to feel when you encounter those sort of things. Think about them, untangle their richness and their history, and you will reach something much, much, much deeper. And that's very positive in a way.
I mean, obviously, I want to buy all the books that are under review in the TLS every week. But this is straight up to the top of my list. This just sounds fascinating.
I think it's a brilliant example of what an academic historian or academic philosopher can do. It's published by Yale University Press, you know, very, very kind of proper, rigorous publishing house. It would have gone out to peer review. You know, it would have passed every single hurdle. But it reads so elegantly and so smoothly, and it connects so deeply with things that one's thinking. This was a book where I absolutely was doing a lot of underlining and stamping on sticky notes all over the place. And I think it's just a really nice example of what can be done when an academic who really has the information and the knowledge and the kind of the capacity to think across time and space, what can be done in the hands of a very skillful writer.
And it's a lovely idea, the idea that all of it is trying to do is just make a bit of space, whether that's physical or emotional or intellectual, and it's that's very helpful to be able to see that as a thread running through all of it, I think.
Absolutely.
Just in time for Christmas. And note to self, not to just, you know, buy every gaudy bauble going.
Exactly.
Catherine, I have to say you've taken us really in depth into that piece. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm just assuming you're going to go off now and pick up all your belongings and see whether they spark joy or not.
Exactly so, yes.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Alex and Lucy.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Margaret Drabble and Catherine Hughes. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Alex Clark and from me, goodbye.